You're listening to the MoneyWeb Now podcast series with Simon Brown. Live streamed every weekday at 6:30 a.m.
It's Wednesday, 28 May. We've got FOMC minutes due 8 p.m. our time. I'm Simon Brown, coming at you live and loud from the MoneyWeb Global Headquarters in Johannesburg, South Africa. On the show today, Jimmy Moyaha, Harmony, buys into copper, and Pepkor. Not bad results from Pepkor, though Brazil, maybe a little light in Brazil. Paul O'Donnell from Green Coat Renewables, European renewable energy market ahead of their June listing. Chris Kutsia from FinFix, talking credit bureaus and how they are changing what they include in their reports, and that will now bring your overdraft facility. That may reduce your borrowing ability. This podcast is brought to you by Stanlib Asset Management. Invest in more global opportunities through their partnership with JP Morgan Asset Management. Morning headlines, MoneyWeb. Liberty sees 18% jump in income protection payouts. Psychiatric and neurological disorders drive claim rises amongst financial industry employees. Business Day, statutory bodies slam budgets proposed fuel levy hike. Increase undermines Treasury's claim that the budget is pro-poor, says Financial and Fiscal Commission. Morning markets. The US was green after being closed on Monday. S&P up 2.1%, NASDAQ 2.4%. The East is mostly red. We got Sydney down 0.6%. Tokyo is the green, up 0.7%. Hong Kong is 0.5% down. Tencent 1.2% lower. Commodities are red. Gold futures, $3,319 an ounce. Brent, $64.49. Platinum, $1,078. Palladium, $984. The Rand is $17.97. Bitcoin, $108,800. And top 40, red open expected, 150 points or a little under 0.2% lower.
MoneyWeb Now, on the money. Also available on podcast.
Chatting now with Jimmy Moyaha. Jimmy, appreciate the early morning time. Pepkor results out yesterday. Brazil may be a little bit light. It's a tough space. Their flash business, as we've seen for a while now, doing well. Your take on this low-cost clothing retailer?
Morning, Si. Pepkor's always been one of my favorite stocks, if I'm honest. The business is huge in terms of its store footprint, in terms of the market segment that they're targeting. They've always done exceptionally well. The share price has held steady as well. So it's nice to see that they're keeping up with the momentum, especially when you look at a business that has more than 5,000 stores. It starts to become difficult to see how you then optimize the profits, the margins, how you keep everything steady. So very good, strong set of numbers from Pepkor. Quite surprising to find out that the Pepkor business is one of the largest prepaid mobile operators in the country, but I suppose that kind of makes sense when you think about their footprint, you think about the offerings that they have and the various businesses that they have or the various brands that they have under the Pepkor stable. So good set of numbers from them. Hopefully the momentum can continue and see how the full year pans out.
Yeah, that little flash business, well, not so little, absolutely a strong business. Then there's Harmony, and I got to say, I love Harmony's sense. They don't play around, and I quote, Harmony adds immediate cash flow from copper production. They're acquiring Mac Copper, Australian business. It is in production already. Of course, they've got to go through the process to actually get it. Just over $1 billion. I don't know. I mean, I like copper. I like cash flow. I got to say, gold and copper, I don't know. Weird bedfellows. Your sense?
So that's quite an interesting acquisition from Harmony's side of it. I mean, at face value, and you look at the reaction that the market had to it, the Mac side of the business or the share price there was up in the double digits in terms of yesterday's trading. And Harmony at the same time was down about 4.5% in terms of day's trading. So it seems as though the market might have been concerned about the acquisition. But if you think about it and you take perhaps a page out of someone like Sibanye-Stillwater that have diversified themselves as a mining company, that's served them well in these down cycles. Now, gold, for the longest time, you and I have looked at gold, Si. We've said that it could potentially be at the top of the cycle, but we don't really know where the top of the cycle is. And if you're anticipating a bit of a sell-off from a gold perspective, you don't want to be concentrated into that one commodity, especially if you've seen what down cycles can look like and how long a down cycle can last on a commodity or a metal like gold. So perhaps from a business perspective, it's a good time to diversify. In terms of timing as well, I mean, you and I have spoken about this as well, Si. When a producer producer like Harmony is able to have an all-in sustained cost of virtually 50% of what they're selling at, it leaves you with a whole lot of cash reserves and a huge influx of revenues, and you might as well put that money to good use. If the money's there at the moment and it's not costing you anything out of capex that you have otherwise, or it's not costing you capex that will put a strain on your business, yeah, then you may as well sit there and say, you know what, there's excess revenue, we had a really good run on gold, and maybe now's a good time to buy something else that could have a really good run. So I think it's not the worst decision they could have made from a diversification perspective. I love a diversified mining business. I love diversification in any kind of investment context, but particularly with the cyclicality that comes with mining. I think it's important to kind of remember that aren't always going to be at this price. Gold price might not always be above $3,000 a fine ounce. And perhaps that's what Harmony's thinking as well.
Yeah, and at some point your costs start to rise. And I mean, their free cash flow in the last year was $9 billion, which is a half of the deal price. So they certainly have that money. Jimmy Muyaha, appreciate the early morning time. That's our poll today, LinkedIn and Twitter. Harmony buys into copper. Do you think this is a good move? Have your vote. Have your say. LinkedIn and Twitter. Let your money benefit from experience with StanLib Asset Management. Find out about StanLib Global Select Fund, which follows an investment discipline that has delivered results for three decades.
MoneyWeb now, on the money.
I'm chatting with Paul O'Donnell, Greencoat Renewables, listing on the JSE on Monday, 9 June. It'll be share code GRP. Paul, appreciate the time. As I understand your business, in some senses, relatively simple, selling renewable energy within the broader European markets.
Yes, Simon, that's correct. Thank you very much for having me on your show this morning and delighted to have an opportunity to speak. I think, look, we know renewable energy and energy more generally is a very strategic and very interesting topic locally in South Africa. And we're delighted to be launching Greencoat Renewables on the Johannesburg Stock Exchange and providing an opportunity for local capital in South Africa to have a chance to invest and play in the European renewable energy story. Our business has been listed for about 8 years now. We listed originally in Dublin in 2017. And over the last 8 years, we've built up a portfolio of about €2.5 billion of assets, which are primarily wind and solar assets. So a large portfolio. And the overall objective of the business is really to give investors stable dividends and to deliver a growing NAV, which we've done on a consistent basis really over the last 8 years.
You've got 1.5 gigawatts already. You mentioned the strategic issues around energy. I mean, there's two drivers. One, of course, is just demand. And I'm thinking EVs, big tech, I mean, just, you know, data centers. The other is that move to renewable, which is probably a lot stronger than it is down here in South Africa. There is a huge push for renewable as distinct from the old fossil energy.
Yeah, and look, Europe has really been, over the last 7 to 10 years, has been really regulating strongly to make that shift to happen. And Europe made the decision to really look to decarbonize the electricity sector as quickly as possible between, I guess, mid-2015 onwards through to 2030. So there's an objective really by 2030 in Europe to be a very decarbonized electricity grid system. You know, what that really means is it requires a lot of capital investment to sort of finance the renewable assets that we see happening across Europe. Mm-hmm. And that is a mix of onshore wind, solar, obviously, which is obviously scaling very, very rapidly, and then offshore wind as well, because we have the right conditions to build a large offshore European market. And more, we're now seeing that increasing alongside levels of storage, so battery storage. We're seeing increasing levels of investment into the grid and stabilizing the grid as well, and providing that sort of inertia that will be needed by the grid as you sort of move away from traditional coal and gas plants and you start to rely a lot more on wind and solar.
How do you get new assets? You've got that 1.5 gigawatts. I mean, do you buy? Do you joint venture? Do you build? What does that process look like?
Yeah, look, to date, we've mostly bought assets that are either in construction or that are operating. So we tend to use experienced developers such as the big European utilities, the Ørsteds, the RWEs, you know, this, those sort of players who essentially have the capability in-house to build these projects and to manage the risk on balance sheet. And then once the assets are de-risked and ready to be operational, we step in and we essentially acquire the right, you know, the operating rights to run these assets for the next 30 years.
I imagine these are, you mentioned 30 years. These are, I mean, I don't know what the phrase is, but these are long-term contracts. I mean, this is not, you're not going to have one of your clients say, we don't need your renewable energy. You're in a contract for that duration pretty much.
Yeah, you're right. Like, look, contracts in Europe have tended to be between 15 and 20 years. And in most European markets, the government tend to underwrite that contract. So that's what gives you really the low risk inflation protected revenues that are kind of reflective of the European market. So any assets that we do buy tend to have those sort of 15 to 20 year type contracts. They generally have inflation built into the contract. So you've got a very, very low risk front end of your cash flows, which essentially is supporting the stable dividends that you can generate. In the more long term, what we tend to see is that, as you rightly point out, the demand for renewable electricity is growing day by day. You know, so we've shown ways where once the assets come out of the contracts, we tend to look to recontract them with companies like data centers or with people who are looking to produce, you know, green fuels such as e-methanol or hydrogen. So there's a very stable market to sell asset and to sell power at, not just when they're operational, but once they get to the end of the contract as well.
I hadn't thought of that. I'd assumed you were sort of selling to power utilities, but do you sometimes sell direct to an end user?
Yeah, very much so. Like, we've done deals in the last 12 months with people like Microsoft, yep, obviously one of the biggest developers of data centers in Europe, and the Singaporean conglomerate Keppel. So, you know, in Europe today, really the story of adding incremental demand that you touched upon. So if you're building data centers, for example, now, you know, you need to come with your own decarbonization story. And yep, therefore, you know, we often sell power of both of new assets and of older assets directly to the data centers. And it's one of the big drivers of revenue stability in the medium term.
Yeah. In the US, I mean, Microsoft is taking on Three Mile Island to get that one of those plants recommissioned. You mentioned dividend, a very strong dividend yield. This is certainly one of the attractions of the investment. I imagine it's part of the strategy of Greencoat Renewables as well.
Yeah, look, our dividend is the backbone of the dividend strategy is the backbone of the business. You know, these are assets that generate stable cash flows. There's generally a high degree of inflation protection in there. And that's allowed us every year since 2017 to grow our dividend in terms of in nominal terms. So we started with a 6 cent dividend against, you know, and our dividend today, I think, is just 6.75 cent. And with where the share price is today, it represents about a 9% dividend yield in European currency. So, you know, in Europe, we tend to see slightly higher interest rates, you know, and we've seen a little more volatility in terms of energy transition stocks. So we think, you know, that 9% dividend yield is reflective of kind of the higher interest rate environment that we're seeing in Europe at the moment and reflecting that in there.
Yeah, fair point, fair point. I leave it there. That's Paul O'Donnell, Greencoat Renewables, as I said, listing 9 June, GRP will be the code. Paul, appreciate the time. Give your money smoother returns with Stanlib Asset Management. The Stanlib Flexible Income Fund's agile investment process preserves and grows capital in all markets.
MoneyWeb now, on the money.
I'm chatting with Chris Kutsia. He is CEO of FinFix. Chris, appreciate the time today. Banks are now, as of I think a couple of months ago actually, required to report overdraft facilities over 500 Rand to credit bureaus in South Africa. Am I correct? This is relatively new and I think in many ways quite important.
Thanks for having me on, Simon. Yeah, this is a new change. I've been looking at credit profiles and credit reports for the past 13 years and overdrafts have never appeared. So it's quite the change to see them on a credit report for a consumer.
It does. I mean, it means ultimately, I mean, I frankly was surprised to learn that they weren't part of it. But then I remember looking at my credit report, never seeing anything there. It does make affordability assessments will become that more accurate.
It will, you know, have all the information for the overdraft will now appear on the credit report, which would give credit providers more information when considering a loan application or a credit application for a consumer.
This, in a sense, I mean, it's going to, I imagine, level the playing field because, yeah, I might have had an overdraft which wasn't being recorded. Someone else might have, in a similar circumstance, but had a, you know, maybe an unsecured loan which would have been reported. This does kind of, I suppose, even it out in many senses.
It does. Consumers will now have to consider how overdrafts affect their access to credit. They will also have to consider how it's reported. There's two factors when credit providers look at when consumers apply for credit. Firstly, consumer payment history. Your credit score is mainly based on your payment history. Consumer payment history is reported for 24 months. Any missed payment on that payment history will haunt you for the next 2 years. But the most important factor to consider is affordability. Credit providers are not allowed to provide credit to consumers who cannot afford their repayments. Consumers who do not have disposable income will not be able to qualify for credit. Mm-hmm. So consumers with the best credit score possible can still be rejected when there's an affordability concern. This is where the recent changes in the reporting of overdrafts will affect each and every consumer who has an overdraft. Their affordability will decrease. In past, when consumers declared overdraft repayments, they would usually include an arbitrary amount because of the situation revolving a credit facility or not declare the overdraft at all. This will not be possible anymore. Credit providers will now consider the amount listed as a repayment amount on the credit report.
And they also, I mean, I imagine part of this would hopefully see, and we'll see in time, that maybe people who therefore manage overdrafts and try and avoid going into this. This could have a, which I imagine is one of the intended consequences, but could actually make some better management of overdraft facilities.
Yeah, this is true. The problem we're having now is the weight an overdraft carries when considering consumers' affordability. While it's debatable if a revolving facility like an overdraft contributes to a lowered affordability the same way a personal loan would, due to the nature of the revolving facility, it is now reported in the same manner. I've recently seen two examples of this. One consumer, for instance, that has an overdraft with their bank of about 38,000 Rand has a minimum repayment amount listed of 1,900 Rand, which means their affordability would now decrease with not 1,900 Rand. Another example, a consumer with an overdraft of about 115,000 Rand with a repayment amount with 5,600 Rand will now have their affordability reduced by 5,600 Rand. So consumers will definitely need to consider the impact of an overdraft when applying for one, and especially if they're considering making a large purchase like a home or a vehicle loan in the near future.
Yeah, for some, it's going to make them harder to get credit.
Yes.
It could also, in the note you put out, you talk around sort of the low-income workers potentially could get hit harder. I mean, this is probably maybe one of the sort of unintended consequences, but there could be some impact at lower income levels.
While it's true that these consumers are more sensitive to changes in the credit industry, and some consumers who will inevitably end up defaulting or having to restructure the debt will now have to do so sooner, I think the long-term moves, you know, in this direction will protect these consumers from harmful lending practices.
Yeah.
Generally, consumers who have to borrow frequently to survive are already spiraling into more debt, and it would benefit them greatly to stop borrowing and break the cycle.
Yeah, I take your point. And I think all around, it is, I mean, to your point, it is a debt. It does change your affordability. I think it's important that it is added. The last point is, as I understand the nuances, it's a 500 Rand over a 30-day period. So if you dip in, I don't know, 50 Rand or something, that's not going to hit. It is a 500 Rand limit in a sense.
Yeah, consumers who use an overdraft strategically would not be affected. I don't think they should worry too much, but they should be mindful of the impact it would have on their future affordability assessments when they start using these overdraft facilities, you know, and they're overdrawn for more than 30 days.
We'll leave it there. Chris Kutsia, CEO of FinFix. Appreciate the time. That's it for today. I was chatting with Keith McLachlan yesterday from Element Investment Managers. We're talking Pick and Pay valuation. He holds the stock in his portfolios, and his logic is less around turnarounds and just almost a sum of the parts. You are getting paid essentially to own the Pick and Pay if you take cash and Boxer valuation into account. We asked you if Pick and Pay offered opportunity for investors. Over 40% said no, it's tough. The rest was split pretty evenly between maybe I'm watching and yes, a great opportunity. Have your vote, have your say, LinkedIn and Twitter. The podcast is brought to you by Stanlib Asset Management. Invest in more certainty to navigate volatile market conditions. We are live every weekday morning, the MoneyWeb website and the app, 6:30 a.m. and podcast just after 7. Thanks to my team, Eddie, Nobuchle, Nicole, to you for listening, my guests for their time. My name is Simon Brown. This is MoneyWeb Now. If you're loving the show, please leave us a positive rating and a 5-star review in your podcatcher of choice. And we'll chat again tomorrow.
You've been listening to another MoneyWeb Now podcast, posted every weekday at 7 a.m. on moneyweb.co.za. MoneyWeb Now, on the money.